Hey guys, welcome back to the Street Cop Training Podcast. My name is Frankie Rodriguez. I am the podcast producer for Street Cop Training. I wanted to do something a little bit different for today's episode since the whole Street Cop crew is out in Nashville, Tennessee right now, laying down some groundwork for the second annual Street Cop Training Conference that we have coming up April 23rd to the 28th of 2023. So for today's episode, I compiled some of the best moments from this week's episodes that I think offer a lot of value for all of our listeners. I will leave the links to the episodes below, so if you like what you hear, you can go back and check those full episodes out. If you're enjoying the content, please remember to subscribe, rate, and share the show with a friend. Also, if you're interested in being a guest or have a suggestion for future guests, you can reach out to me. My email is frankie@streetcop.com. So without further ado, here are some of the best moments from this week's episodes. Enjoy. 111,
You know, I started changing my behavior. You know, I literally, especially when it came to diet, when I was younger, I treated my body like a landfill. I really did. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I kind of came around in my later years because I had to, and I wish I would have known then what I know now, and would have had more of an eye to longevity, when it came to, you know, what I was putting into my body and how I was approaching working out. And I learned a lot of those lessons late. And that was one of the reasons I wrote the book is, you know, I wrote the book for men over 40, but I've had readers as young as 26 contact me and say, you know, I'm going to put this into practice now. You know, you talk about all the injuries that you have and how you had to learn things the hard way. And I am going to try to benefit from your experience and your lessons learned so that I can have even more longevity. And I think that that's really important.
I'm constantly educating. I'm in books nonstop, podcasts nonstop. A book that I recently picked up after hearing, and again, same space as you, was a book by Mark Sisson. I'm sure you're familiar with Mark is. Mm-hmm. Two Meals a Day, which literally the first three chapters changed my life. Mm-hmm. You know, don't eat processed foods, don't eat carbs, and stay away from sugars. So at 40, mm-hmm. I finally had this unlock of like, oh shit, I can't eat carbs like this.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, it's, I've gone through periods where I've been on very strict low carb diets. And, you know, this is a debate that goes back and forth. It's something that Mike Dolce and I have talked about, Max Lugavere and I have talked about. It's not, you know, it knowing, you know, things like the glycemic index, you know, whether you're eating basically good carbs or bad carbs is kind of key. And, but, you know, the big thing you said right out of the gate, I think is the most important is the processed food. And I tell people if somebody's handing it to you through your car window, that's not how nature intended you to live.
Yeah. So where I left off the first podcast was me coming home from my hospital stay and having my stomach come undone and essentially my guts hanging out in front of my kid and my parents. And they had to rush me back to the hospital. So oddly enough, I came back home that night later on. I got home in the morning, like around 10 a.m. and stayed at the hospital all day running tests and whatnot. And they sewed me back up and I made it home. The next morning, I found out that my wife was pregnant. So I died three times in the hospital the night I was shot. I would have died and never known I had another baby cup. Imagine the tragedy there. Mm-hmm. Right? So I found out my wife was pregnant. 9 months later, on my birthday, on July 30th, my boy was born.
That's great.
So instead of God taking my life that night, he gave me a life. So, of course, what's on my mind is I'm the provider, right? As most men are, and especially if you're a cop, we're dominant. You know, we're the alpha male of the house. At least we think we are anyway, right? I got to earn. I got to take care of my family. I got a mortgage to pay, car payments, other obligations like everybody else. And that started weighing on me. As I'm only getting my base salary, there's no more extra jobs. We call them details up here in Mass. No detail money, no court, no overtime, nothing. It's a major hit for me financially. So this starts weighing on me. I start learning about retirement and how much I'm going to get. And I came upon a thing called special legislation. I don't know if you know about it or any of your listeners do. But in this state of Mass, I found out through my digging, being a detective, in 2010, when I got shot, at that point, there were only 53 officers before me who had been shot, stabbed, run over, whatever, violently injured in the line of duty. Their respective municipalities wrote up, the mayor or the town manager of those jurisdictions wrote up special legislation which supersedes the 72%, what you normally get, and it gives you 100%.
That's great.
Gives you 100%. So I called my chief up and I said, hey, listen, did you know this exists? He says, yeah, I do. I said, well, can you put me in for it? And he did the paperwork and filed it up to the city hall. I waited around 2.5 years for an answer from my mayor and heard shit. Heard nothing. Every couple of weeks, I call the station, talk to my chief and say, hey, what's the deal? Is he going to give me this or not? And the chief would say to me, Mario, I don't know. They have meetings up there all the time relative to your retirement, but I'm not invited. I'm not privy to the conversations. They're not letting me in the meetings. So needless to say, by me sitting at home trying to recover, here I am. Like, I feel like the redheaded stepchild. Like, I was a hero one day, and you're right next to me when the news is here. And now when I want to retire and get what I deserve, you abandon me? You just ignore me? You just leave me out there to high and dry? So that did a number on me mentally. I was at home worrying and wondering what the city was going to do, if they were going to really help me. Because I had another baby now. I'm seeing my wife work extra hours at her work to help me make ends meet. And I mean, I felt like a burden. I became a burden to my own family.
Uh-huh.
I became a burden. It was a disaster.
Let's go into what occurred. I'm very familiar with the circumstances. We talked about it in Atlantic City. I remember you telling me about it. I find it interesting. And I think there's some good, real good points for police administrators and people who are co-workers and people who are maybe getting involved in this job to understand the responsibility of being a part of this job and that it may not be for everybody. So let's go on to what had occurred.
You know, so I worked, I was working deep nights. So 10 p.m. to 8 a.m. was our shift. So I went in April 25th thinking it was going to be a good day. Started out with my normal routine, pulling a couple of traffic stops here and there just to kind of get the ball rolling and stuff. And then got sent to an accident which turned into a good DWI arrest. And kind of while I'm at this arrest, I get, you know, I started hearing like some radio chatter about we're assisting another city with the chase and our canines getting involved. And, you know, all of a sudden it bails out in our city. So now everyone's kind of going there. And essentially the whole city ended up trying to help this other city with finding these three suspects. It was a good aggravated robbery and eventually leads to what I kind of told you that day at the conference where we lost a canine, right? He was, he was murdered pretty ruthlessly. It was a little rough for a lot of us. But essentially it came to the part where it's like, do I go help my canine buddy find his dog or do I be the only unit available in the whole entire city to take calls? So I chose to be the only unit available in the whole entire city to take calls. So I worked the South End. They sent me to an assault in progress at the North End by myself. And that's kind of where I thought like, tonight's going to suck. Like, I don't feel right about this, but you know, it's our job. We got to go do what we got to go do. Right. So I go to this house, I'm talking to the complainant and she's like, yo, he walked down the street when you were coming down. I turned around, found him. He's a big dude. Right. So I put him at gunpoint because it's just me by myself, got him down on the ground, took him into custody without any incident and stuff like that. And another unit ended up clearing off of that call to come take it because it was her beat. And so a burglary dropped in the South End and one of our sergeants went to go take it. And so me being the proactive type person I was like, hell, this is going to be fun. I'll take it from Sarge. We'll be good. So I get there and as I'm exiting my vehicle, we get a call of a shooting dropping one street over. And it like, there's no time delay or anything like that. So I'm like, this is weird because I heard zero gunshots whatsoever. I'm like, okay, I'll go to that. So I look at one of my buddies who's not the guy who ended up going with. And I was like, hey, you and me, let's go to this call. It should be easy, quick. I mean, the kid doesn't have a gun, but he's saying his mom was shot. So I was like, let's go do this. Let's go get a life-saving work, right? Also told dispatch, like, hey, have an ambulance staged down the street just in case this actual, you know, someone actually is shot so we can get this thing rolling pretty quickly. So the first address we go to ends up being the wrong address, right? And the guy I ended up going with was a friend of mine at the time, and it was his beat. So he told the other person I was supposed to go with, hey, why don't you stay here with Sarge? I'll go with Hicks, and we'll go get this taken care of. The other things that kind of like stood out to me is, right, so we have a shooting, not really in progress. We don't know if there's a weapon actually involved or not. No one's seen a gun or anything. There's no notes about that. But he decides to deploy his rifle. To this day, still don't understand why he did that, but he did. So the first house we went to was the wrong address. You know, knocked on the door. Old people answered the door, and I was like, you don't have some weird person in your house. And they're like, no. It's like, all right, cool. See you later. Then we turned around and kind of went. I got on the air, asked to confirm the address. They told me it was across the street from where we were. That's where the phone was pinging from. So we went across the street, knocked on the door. Family opened the door, answered, and they were like, hey, the dude just ran out the window. So I was like, okay, cool. Show me which window so I know where we can set up our perimeter and kind of get that done. So it's on the east side of the house, went out the daughter's room. And so I looked at my buddy and I was like, hey, you hold the back side, I'll hold the front side. We'll get more cover, set up a perimeter. At this time, I'm doing my whole thing, you know, like searching the area, making sure front side's okay. And I hear my partner give out a call, and he's like, all I hear him say is, get your hands up, get your hands up. So in my mind, he's got one at gunpoint and I need to go help, right? What I don't remember and what they told me, like my video shows, is I slam open a gate to go help him. In my head, I don't remember slamming open the gate, but I guess that's just one of the things, like when you hit a trauma, you kind of forget some stuff, right? But I remember, you know, slicing the pie, making sure everywhere I go is cleared and I got good cover and everything like that. And as I'm coming to the edge of this garage, like how the house was, the driveway was in the back off of alleyway and it was covered, and there's a garage. There was two cars. There was a van and another car. And I'm walking in between the garage and the van. My gun comes around the corner, and I guess my partner only sees my light and decides to pull the trigger. So he puts a 5.56 through my right arm, completely blows it open. It went in through, right, it entered my bicep, and then completely blew up my whole entire tricep. I got in the air, told dispatch, you know, 162, we got shots fired, I've been hit. And as I'm doing that, I'm moving around cover because we're always tired. Once you get hit, you know, try to get off the X, right? Move your ass away. So I'm doing that. And by this time, I guess my partner has unfroze and is coming to me, and I'm yelling swear words left and right at him because, you know, he just put a round through my arm. I cussed him out.
Did you realize it was him at that point that he did that?
Yeah. Oh, I knew it was him from the get-go because right, once you kind of end this job long enough and you go to the range enough that you can kind of tell the distinct sounds between a rifle and a pistol and everything like that. And again, our call notes never actually said that this person had a weapon. But once the round entered my arm, right, I felt the burn and then I felt nothing else. So my body went into that shock phase when you're in a, you know, experiencing a high trauma. Luckily, my partner who did come to as I'm cussing him out was able to apply a tourniquet to me. And I made sure he put it in the right place and had it tight enough. And then told me he can go fuck himself. And I walked my ass into the ambulance and we were off to Baylor.
We talked about these people who are addicted to opioids and that's fueling them going out and being prostitutes in the sex business. You know, and it's easy to put a label on these people, but when you start to humanize and understand people who are addicted to opioids, and I think it takes some time in the field to understand, have some compassion. Generally, what a lot of people don't realize is once you get these people back to your police department and you're going through processing, especially for a patrol officer, you get to hear the story of why or how somebody became addicted to opioids. And I want to emphasize to everybody in here, listen, open your ears. When you're bringing people back to the police department, these people, these opioid addicted people will always open up and explain everything to you. I had a girl one time, and I know her name. I remember it. And she was constantly in trouble. You know, she came up on the radar for us nonstop out of nowhere. And this happens sometimes. She's got this name. It's floating around the police department. Everybody knows who she is. And I said to her one time, I'm like, hey, do you ever think about, like, you know, trying to get help? She was being processed. And she told me a story how she was 13 years old and her stepfather injected her with heroin when she was 13. So she was in eighth grade and the stepfather had injected her against her will with heroin to get her high. And she said, from that point forward, I was addicted. So when we think about these people, we are so quick to cast judgment against them. But imagine being that girl trying to now fight. She was like 18, 19 years of age, now being charged as an adult with all these hair. She's always caught up in these heroin busts that we're doing. She's always there. Right. And she told me, I mean, she wasn't a bad person. She's like, I am addicted since I'm 13 years of age and I can't get off the stuff. So coming from a background like that, we have to have compassion of why somebody might be a prostitute on, I don't know what websites they're using now, but on a website where they're trying to promote and sell themselves to support this habit. Let's go a little bit deeper into how did they end up here? And I think if you really dug into that, you'd find yourself having a lot of compassion. I'm not saying it makes it legal. I'm not saying, but maybe it just humanizes a little more of how did they end up here? This is another human being. We're talking about law enforcement. And again, a lot of people are going to hear this. Why would somebody be apprehensive to get into meditation and some of the benefits of it and some of that, those first myths?
Yeah. So our parents used to punish us when we were little by putting us in timeout, go sit in the corner, sit still, go sit, go think about what you've done. And that's, I mean, maybe consciously or subconsciously, when we hear meditation, you're like, wait, I'm going to go and sit with my thoughts. You want to listen to this bully in my brain? No, thanks. I would rather drink, smoke pot, watch Netflix, watch porn, take pills. I will do anything other than listen to the voice in my brain. And so because there's this rampant misconception that the point of meditation is to clear the mind or quiet the mind, which is impossible, which we'll talk about in a moment, people, one, think, well, I can't do that because I'm going to be failing. And none of us will do anything for very long that we feel like we're failing at. And then two, nobody wants to listen to the bully in their brain. There's billions of dollars of industry built on top of ensuring that you never have to feel a feeling and that you never have to sit with your thoughts, right? We're like constantly distracted. Like you're in an elevator for 20 seconds. What are you doing? Scrolling through Instagram. You're at a red light for 1 minute. Let me just check my emails. Like the thought of sitting still is terrifying for most people. Mm-hmm. And then you say, oh, 15 minutes. People are like, I'm no way. I have ADHD. I have ADD. I can't sit still. And so the thing that I want people to understand is that meditation is a skill. It is a skill. And if you don't have any training, and if you don't have a technique that's designed for you, and you try and sit still for 15 minutes, it is going to feel like torture. You are going to think that you're failing. And so just like you wouldn't magically expect yourself to start speaking Japanese tomorrow, or magically expect to be able to tap dance or do gymnastics without ever taking a class, why on earth would you expect yourself to be able to magically be able to meditate without training in the skill? And here's the really good news. Once you have a technique that's made for you and not a monk, and once you have training, then you actually start to look forward to it, right? Like you and I just said, like, I crave it. My day is better. I enjoy it so much when I do it, but that's because we took the time to get a tool that was designed for us and get some training.